How you doing?
My name is Alex Lutsky. I live in Staten Island, and I work for the New York City Fire Department as a medic. And I had a very dramatic experience during September 11th, which everyone I know in the United States and Western Europe were affected by it. And I was, by chance, there that day as it happened, and it, almost providentially. And it was about 8:48, I believe that's the correct time. I was about 30 seconds away from the World Trade Center. It was before me, and I was in my ambulance with my partner, Eric Ramos, and we were having small talk, and then I looked in front of me, and I saw a plane, and I said to him, Eric, that plane looks like it's gonna hit, you know. And about 2 seconds later, it slammed right into the North Tower and exploded, and looked like something you saw on television, you know. And quick as a flash, I took the radio and I confirmed a mass casualty incident, and an aviation mass casualty incident, and we went straight away to the site, which took us about 30 seconds to get there. When we got there, there was part of the landing gear on the northeast side of the North Tower, and there was a lot of people scurrying about there. And then about 10 to 15 seconds later, there was a swell of people that came out of the World Trade Center. It was a tremendous rush of thousands of people that were running for their lives out from the World Trade Center. There were more people than you can count. It was we were the first unit on the scene, and we were overwhelmed. We knew not what we could do. There were people who were then running out. Many screaming, some of them standing still in almost like a catatonic state, looking at the building and not moving. They're frozen in place. And then subsequent from that, you would have a lot of people coming out with various types of injuries, burned, broken arms, running with broken arms, you know, lacerations, all kinds of things, all running for their lives. Each one of them had sheer terror written on their faces. We tried to do the best we could, and a lot of what we were trained to do came out. We used to always, year after year, prepare for like a mass casualty incident, and you never knew how it would really work out until you're really there. We were at fires and other things like that, but nothing to this this magnitude. This, in the emergency system, is called a disaster. A disaster is defined as an event that overwhelms the emergency services system for a particular municipality or state. And so that's when we would welcome all, you know, fire companies, police departments, and you know, EMS stations from the tri-state area. And at any rate. We were trying to set up a triage, and what we do with a triage is we sort out people in terms of the varying degrees of injuries that they may have, how severe they are. What the philosophy behind it is that we want to do the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And sometimes decisions that are made where sacrifices have to be done so that the greatest good would be done for the greatest number. Around that time, we were on West Street in between VC and Liberty Street, and unbeknownst to me, because I was right in front of the building, I heard an explosion, and after that there was a tremendous showering of shrapnel and all kinds of debris, metal, glass, everything that fell. What protected me at that time was there was an overpass between the World Trade Center and the Financial Center, And I happened to have been standing there at that time when it happened. And I didn't know what it was at that time. I thought it might have been a bomb or something like that. I didn't know a second plane hit because I was there and I didn't see it from a distance. And so at that time, me and my partner, when all this thing was raining down, I told him, let's rush into the ambulance. It's right across the street, and it was under the underpass, and let's get out of here. Everybody had already, like, evacuated that area. Anyone that didn't was already crushed by what came down. As soon as we went in, we went straight away from West Street towards Liberty. And a lot of debris was raining down. And when we looked to our left, where we wanted to make a left, we realized that we couldn't. Because that whole side of the World Trade Center, the South Building, had already pretty much flooded with metal, that whole street and the firehouse that was there. So we weren't able to get through, and we couldn't stay much longer because there was a lot of other shrapnel, as I say, and metal hitting the ambulance and the glass and so forth and so on, and it was too dangerous. So we turned around real quick, went West Street, went up VC, came around, and we found ourselves back in Fulton Street and Church, where we had originally started, and we once again started to do a triage in front of the building to try to do the greatest amount of good for the greatest amount of number of people. At this point, this became now a major evacuation effort. And so we wanted to get everybody out. And my function at that time was I was a staging officer. I was right in front of the World Trade Center. And I had to decide who would go where and when. And so, like, if I had I had people that were burned badly or had long bone fractures or whatever, they may be bleeding internally pretty badly, I had to decide which ones are going to go into which ambulances and where they're going to go. So I might have six people in the back of one ambulance, and they may have varying degrees of minor fractures to the arms or the shoulders or so forth and so on. But they could manage. They'll be able to breathe. They're it's not life threatening at this time. I would send them out to Long Island Jewish Hospital and save the neighboring hospitals for the more severe. And there were quite a number of them. And so we had a major task in our hand. A lot of people had to be lifted, carried, you know, run with them while you're carrying them, you know. And that's what we had. We had a major evacuation effort going on at that time. That went on for some time. And then there was a tremor on the ground. And I looked up, and a lot of people started to scream and run. As I looked up, I saw the North Tower of the World Trade Center, maybe about 2-3 stories of it, collapse right on top of it and just come down like a stack of cards, like like that, and then just come down even faster like that. There was really no place for me to go. I had no place to go. And I just saw that. I saw it come down a few times, and I ran maybe 5 feet one way, then ran 5 feet the other way, and I'm saying, where am I going to go? You know, there's no place for me to go. I can't beat this thing. There's nowhere safe for me. And after I thought that, I turned around, and then the next thing I knew, the whole thing had come down. Everything went totally black. I couldn't hear anything. I couldn't see anything. And I couldn't breathe. The last half breath that I took filled my mouth with pulverized concrete that was bigger than a golf ball, a couple of golf balls. And I couldn't take a breath. I was really asphyxiating at that point. And I couldn't hear anything or see anything. Now, in my mind during this time, I realized that, for the most part, I was realizing that I wasn't going to make it, because I knew that all that debris that came down isn't going to settle fast enough for me to breathe. It's just not going to. And I realized that while I was holding my breath for the first minute. And my mind went straight to the Lord, and I wasn't really so interested in having my life saved, as it were. You know, I was more interested in whether or not I had made my calling election sure, whether or not I was ready for this transition. And that was of more concern to me. And I had, in that space of time, that was my prayer. As time went on, the will to live, to survive, which is instinctive, I believe, in the Lord's creatures, panicked me. I needed to take a breath of air. I was out of air. I needed a breath of air. I was going to die, you know. And I no longer was thinking about. It wasn't a thought process now. It was more like automatic pilot, like a fright flight kind of thing. And so I was, just before that, I was just pretty much giving up. I was collapsing on the floor. And I still couldn't see anything, and I couldn't hear anything. And then I stood up, and I took my radio, which was on the side, and I said, no. In my mind, I said, no, I'm not ready. And so I started banging it around me, and it was solid. I felt solid things, but there was so much debris that it affected your fingertips in terms of being able to tell what it was or what substance you were feeling. You didn't know if you were touching wood, metal, plastic, anything. So I started banging my radio, and something gave way. But again, you can't really hear what's going on. Later on, I found out that it was the window of a van. And I put my hands inside, and I felt around, and I started to actually feel a little bit more in there, because those things weren't affected as much with the debris. But there was a vacuum. I didn't mention that. The tremendous vacuum, the amount, when that building collapsed, the amount of air pressure and the amount of noise that happened was, I think, enough to cause insanity. They say that if you are subjected to like 120 decibels or more, maybe 150 decibels, that a sustained period of time, it can cause insane kind of behavior. This was, I don't know, a couple of volcanic eruptions or something. It was the loudest, most powerful thing I have ever experienced in my life. I would say that it was, I describe it, being a Bible student, I describe it, I know that in the book of Revelation it talks about God having four angels that are holding the four winds in the earth, and these four winds representing a lot of turbulence and destruction that would come upon the earth, such as never was ever realized since there was any kind of nation or government or country. And I pictured it, what I experienced, as a breeze rushing by those angels, and that's what that was. It was a tremendously dramatic, terrific event that is almost beyond description. And anyone that had experienced it and came out of it alive is not the same. I would say you're either better as a person or you're worse as a person. But very little middle ground. But at any rate, at this juncture, I went into the van that I didn't know was a van at the time, and I went into it up to my waist, and I put my head down low, which would be the ground of the van, and you know, the inside of it down below at the floor of the van, and I had my turnout coat, which is my, it's a coat that we use at work, you know, it looks like bunker gear that firefighters use. And I wrapped that around my face, and I took very short breaths, because there was still pressure, still particulate matter, and it would be like breathing in sand, or, you know, being drowning in sand or something. And so I had to coach myself at this time to not feel panicky or greedy, and just to take a little air that I had, little short breaths, almost like breathing out of a coffee stirrer, you know, the hole of a coffee stirrer. And I did that for a little while, and it wasn't adequate in terms of being able to make me feel like I took a breath in, but it kept me alive. And after doing that, I don't know how long that was. I was in a tunnel vision at that point with time. The next thing I remembered was I was able to see a little bit, almost like a thick fog. If I stretched my hand out in front of me, all the way in front of me, I wouldn't be able to see my fingers anymore. But if I brought it in just slightly, ever so slightly, I'd be able to see my hand. That's what type of visibility I had at this time, which was a vast improvement with what was, because it was total blackness, total darkness. Dark. No light whatsoever. And I knew that was that two blocks down, there was an emergency room. And I didn't know. I thought we were hit. I thought this was, we were hit by bombs, maybe even biological stuff, I thought in my mind. And so I went down to the emergency room, and I was coughing up granules and, you know, pieces of pulverized concrete and glass and all kinds of things. My whole neck was hurting me from, it almost felt like, I don't know if anyone's familiar with fiberglass when you're putting up insulation in your house. Well, my whole neck was like that, twice as bad. It felt like I had glass embedded in my neck. And I went to the ER, and as soon as they saw me, they rushed me. They had a lot of things going on in that emergency room. That was NYU Downtown Hospital. It's on Gold and Water Street. And that looked like a war zone. It looked, you had people with tremendous injuries there, missing limbs, dying, blood all over the place. And as soon as they saw me, you know, they right away got oxygen for me. They hosed me down, you know, because I had so much particulate matter on me, and they tried to clear my airway. And they also put a pulse oximeter right on my finger, which, what that does is it puts a light through my fingernail, which is able to register if there's any, you know, how much oxygen is saturated in my blood, which is very important. So they found that I was starting to get some oxygen. After I was got my bearing a little bit and I was able to get some breath, I had to go back and find out where my partner was, where everyone was, and what I could do to further do my job. And so I went back, and it was devastated. The area was devastated. It looked like a war had just taken place. My ambulance was in flames, and later on, it made the front page of Fire Rescue and some other professional magazines with Emergency Medical Services and Fire Department, as well as Police Department. And it was in flames. And I went back, and I met up with a firefighter whom I didn't know, and a police officer whom I didn't know. And the three of us decided to stay together and not separate. And we were going to try to do our prospective roles as emergency workers to the best that we can in the absence of a command. And so we started out doing that. And as we, first thing we wanted to do is we wanted to see at the scene that we were at if there were any of members of our crews there, and, you know, if they needed any assistance, and, you know, if they, the ones that made it, you know. And we really didn't find many people you know. And about that time, then, the floor started to feel like an earthquake again. I was standing on Fulton Street and Day, D-E-Y is the name of the street. It's right by Century 21. And now we have the South Tower coming down. The North Tower coming down. The South Tower was the first to come down. It was the second one to get hit, but it was the first one to come down. The North Tower is the first to get hit, but it was the second to come down. So I correct myself. North Tower is coming down. And as soon as the three of us, because we were three were survivors, felt the tremor, we ran without even looking at each other, without a word, and were able to make it up one block, which was a short block. Now, you got to understand, when that building starts coming down, it looks like it's slow motion, but it's not. To be able to beat that, you really have to, be fast. And we made it so that we were able to go into this chocolate store. It had a lot of glass jars of old-fashioned chocolate, you know, chocolatier kind of shop, you know, gourmet kind of thing. And when we shut the door, it almost didn't close from the amount of pressure that came from that building when it came down. And everything went totally black. And even inside the store, you can see from areas where there was some kind of breach in the building, where there would be, and there was enough pressure for it, where you'd see like puffs of black smoke coming in because of the amount of pressure, and it was able to get in there, but it wasn't enough to affect us. But we didn't know that we wouldn't get crushed, because you're talking about a building that's a quarter mile high compared to one that's five stories high. And we, at that time, didn't know the construction of the World Trade Center, being that it was a exoskeleton instead of an endoskeleton, and that it comes down as like an implosion. But still, that's enough to devastate a whole block, you know, easily. And so we weren't sure, but anyway, there was a radio going on in there. And all I heard was news and talking about Palestinians taking credit for this. Or maybe not Palestinian terrorists taking credit for this. It sounded like we were at war. And if you were where we were at, you would think that you were at war, without a doubt. And in our minds, we were saying, well, what else is hit? California? You know, is that hit too? Washington, D.C., is that hit? We don't know. And there was, in that radio, another thing talking about that the Pentagon was hit, or something like that. It was very vague, and we didn't know. And so we started saying, well, you know, we better start saving some water, because the water mains are going to go, more than likely, with this destruction, you know, in the area. So we started emptying out the chocolate that were in these glass jugs into plastic garbage bags, which would be used as food if we needed it. And we would clean out the inside of the glass jugs and fill them with water while we felt there was still water to be had. And we would seal them with plastic. And we did that for, I don't know, a couple of hours or so. And it seemed that way. It's hard for me to know what the time frame was, because, like I said, we're like in tunnel vision at this point. And we start looking outside, and we start seeing things are settling again. And it almost looks like a light fog at this point. You know, and we had saved a lot. We saved a lot of water and stuff like that. So then we figured we'd go out there and find out who survived, and from who survived, who might need help. So you had the firefighter breaking into places, and you had the medic, me, being there for anybody that needed me, and you had the cop helping out too. And what we found as we were going down the block was there was lots of people that were hiding in basements of the buildings, and they survived. And we asked them if they needed any water, and we asked them, you know, if anyone was hurt, if anyone needed any medical assistance. And they said no. And we went from building to building to building until we went down two city blocks. And when we made it down these two city blocks, we saw the first semblance of a command. We saw the first fire chief. He was in a car, and there were others around him. And we then began to realize that the devastation that we saw was pretty isolated. Because as we started to go more and more down, we saw that a lot of things weren't affected now, you know. And the fire chief was saying, no, it's the World Trade Centers. They also said that the Pentagon was hit. He confirmed that. And so then he ordered me to go to the engine company on South and Pike Street and register my name and my shield number, because they have me as missing, dead, perhaps a casualty. And so they wanted to get the numbers right. So he told me that's the first thing I want you to do, you know. So I went there. You know, we walked there. Me, the firefighter, had to do the same thing. And we went there together. And when I got there, I put it in the fire log, you know, my name and my shield. And then my next order was to go back to the site for the recovery effort. As I was going down there, I met up with another chief, and he changed the command because he says that the mayor has just issued a directive that the city from Canal Street down is going to be evacuated. I need you to direct the evacuation part in Lower Manhattan by the Staten Island Ferry Terminal. And so I wasn't to go back to the site at that point. And so I worked on the evacuation of Lower Manhattan for a number of hours till late at night. And and then we worked each day at the site trying to find people that were alive, potentially alive. We believed that there were people under there that could potentially be alive. And I felt very guilty surviving. That was my first human reaction. And I felt the way to best deal with that was to work as hard as I could to try to be of assistance to anybody that was under there, you know, and that helped me. I thought that was therapeutic. I think it also this experience was very instrumental in my Christian walk with God. Hold on with one second. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. I was talking about how this was of great effect on my Christian walk. I guess the near-death experience made things very real for me. I'd studied the scriptures for many years, for 15 so years, and this experience really gave me the feeling like many times in the apostles' days. I remember Apostle Paul would say about the brethren back then, you know, oh, don't get so riled up as though the day of the Lord is coming right now. No. Well, a man of sin first has to be revealed, and other things have to take place before these things happen. And what I drew from that was that they were always in this expectation, like tomorrow was the day. And I think even in Brother Russell's time it was like that. And it made me feel like back in the time when the Jewish people were coming out of Egypt, staff in hand, ready to go at night. And this, I believe, was how it was for the Bible students in the harvest period, especially when the chronology had pointed towards 1914. And I think that when that didn't turn out to be exactly correct, although it was correct. It just wasn't exactly correct. I almost feel like I, and perhaps others in the Bible student movement, had this feeling like it's not coming tomorrow. Maybe it's be delayed even longer. Maybe 5 years, 10 years, maybe 50 years. Who knows? You know. But this experience makes you feel like, you know, your day, we live in this 24-hour period. That could be your day. That could be the end of your day. Or it could be the end of this age, too. We don't know the exact time of the hour. And so my Christian walk now is staff in hand, because I don't know the day or the hour precisely. And I want to be pleasing to the Heavenly Father, and I want my consecration to not be a lukewarm one. I want it to be as fervent as it was when I started my walk. That way I can grow spiritually. And this experience helped me in that effect, in that capacity. And I'm very grateful for it. I'm grateful for all my experiences, and I can see how all of them have helped me in becoming stronger as a Christian and spiritually stronger. And I think obedience to our Heavenly Father will be victorious in all things. And I think this experience helped me in the area of obedience too. I don't think I was very disobedient as it were, but I'm saying that it certainly drove home many lessons and many things that I perhaps intellectually understood or appreciated became much more real for me, this experience. So I'm grateful for it. It was a tragedy. The aftermath, as far as my flesh is concerned, is I had, for some time, I had problems. I had 20% reduction in my breathing capacity. And the fire department tests your lungs every year. And it had decreased about 20%. My partner's decreased more. In fact, he could not come back to work. His lungs were too hurt by the event, and he had to be under nebulizer treatments and other kind of treatments on a daily basis. In fact, he also suffered psychologically to this event, that even I believe it was 6 or 8 months after the event he was psychiatrically hospitalized, unfortunately, and he was never able to come back to work, and he's on disability now for his lungs and also for post-traumatic stress syndrome, as it is. My lungs were also affected, and it was about 20% affected, and I could feel it. But it just improved over time. And what was interesting was that when I did my last lung exam at the fire department, my lungs had improved so much so that it was better than when I even started at the fire department, which was before the World Trade Center. I don't know how that could be, but that's what it is. And the doctor was very perplexed by it and had the test redone, and it was really no different. It was the same. And so he just laughed and said, you've got great lungs, you know. So I'm grateful that my lungs rebounded well from that. I know that there are others that are not as fortunate, you know. And so health-wise, I've recovered. And now, since then, I've been on a wonderful spiritual journey. I'm meeting with August at his home. Now I'm living in Staten Island, and Mark Allen and Fred Nealon and Isaac I met online, and now he's meeting with us here too. And it's such a wonderful experience. And I don't know what else to say. Any questions?
So you covered it beautifully. Anyone have any other questions or anything?